Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Better Than Life. It's the podcast where a lapsed fan, a constant fan, and a comedian talk about Red Dwarf. I'm Fergus.
And I'm John, and I cannot wait to watch Series 3 of Red Dwarf for the first time in 30 years. Let's kick off with Backwards and Vic Slayton.
Let's go!
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company and evolved cat and a hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that It's Better Than Life.
John, this week's guest is going to kick off Series 3 with an enormous bang. She's a stand-up comedian, she's an award-winning finance expert off the telly and everything, but she's here today in her capacity as a big fan of Red Dwarf. It's Vic Slayton!
Hey.
Thank you so much for being here, Vic.
That is, you know what, the Red Dwarf fan is one of the most important things about me, so thank you for prioritising that where it should be. I've been waiting years for people to ask, so thanks for having me.
Well, do they? How much of a fan? Do people who know that you're a fan?
No, not so much. It's weird. I think as adults, unless you are permanently online as I am, so there are a certain amount of people that I can talk to about anything, that, like, people on Twitter that I've never met who know me better than people I've known in real life for years and years and years, so they know. But when you're walking around the world in real life, people just don't ask you what your favourite TV show is anymore.
That's a real shame.
It's really boring. Like, what's your job? No MC at a comedy gig has ever asked me, what's your favourite TV show? And do you know what? I think it'd be more interesting. So
we've found doing this podcast, I think the answer a lot of times might be Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
It seems to have really captured a lot of people's imagination, especially people who love comedy or are into comedy. Would you describe yourself as a geek? Are you a sci-fi fan as well?
Yeah, I think it's my dad wanted a more sort of traditional son, I think, but made do with a daughter. Right. So my mum worked nights, so my dad would, it was Deep Space Nine, Star Trek, Babylon 5. So all of the kind of space opera, pretty much fed a diet of total sci-fi and fantasy.
Vix, how did you feel about Red Dwarf when you came to it?
I was offensively young thinking about it now. Like, I mean, like, was it an appropriate watch for a kid? Because I'm watching it back with new eyes. I think it pretty much was. It was good enough. Like,
how old are we talking?
It started in 1988 and I'm 40 this year. And I pretty much watched it, if not in real time, only a couple of years after. So I was probably primary school age.
Yeah, that is youthful.
Yeah. And I thought they were so old. That's the worst thing, because I've done a recent rewatch in the run-up to the episode. I've done a rewatch of some of the greatest hits episodes. And I remember thinking they were like proper grown-ups, and that Holly, male Holly, was like, oh, he was an old man. And I Googled it and he's not far off the age I am now. And I had a crisis about it, is what I'm saying. An existential crisis.
It's really tricky, isn't it? That's a real marker on age. That.
Oof, yeah. Yep.
And I'm the same age as this person who I thought was flipping ancient.
Yeah, they're so young. Of course they're silly. They're just kids.
To be fair, Lister and Rumour, they look like they've been through a lot, right? Mm. Dave Lister's supposed to be like 25 in these
but
episodes.
But they were. That was the age they were, because I fell down a deep Wikipedia hole, obviously.
Sure.
Because then I was like, no, surely they're older. They're like the Buffy actors where there were 40 playing like high school kids, but no, they were pretty legit the age that they were. they were just, it was different time, wasn't it? There was, you were allowed to smoke indoors. And I think that did affect it.
If you were already a bit in a bit of a sci-fi household, how did you get on with the comedy? You could almost be like a bit upset. Hey, they're not taking sci-fi seriously, but it's not a parody of sci-fi, is it? They're making jokes using sci-fi.
I think because I was so young, it didn't really occur to me to be a genre purist. I just watched the TV that my parents watched. There were like four channels. So yeah, it was Home and Away, then Johnny Bravo, Heartbreak High, which was a little bit progressive for my age, and then probably Red Dwarf to finish the evening before I was put to bed. So the comedy stuff, that's, like I said, that's what I was brought up on. So it was that, it was Victoria Wood. It was like, for me, it was all, anything that had that kind of levity to it was, I was obsessed with it. Right the way up until a teenager, I used to listen to comedy albums like other people listen to pop albums. Like, I was such a fan, and I don't know what flavour neurodiversity I've got, but I would watch my favourite episodes of things over and over and over again to reciting levels. And I know that is not unusual in the circles that I'm in, but it was a proper comfort show. I had all the videos, the Smeg Up and the Smeg Out videos. I had the little bit of cardboard tucked into the VHS so we could tape over and have all the episodes together.
That was a weird time, right? That was a weird time in comedy to be buying. Why were they releasing outtake videos? Bottom did it as well, didn't they? They were amazing. They were brilliant. I watched them. There were periods where I'd watch them more than the actual episodes, I think.
My first ever experience with comedy, actually, was Norman Lovett's stand-up bit on one of the either Smeg Up or Smeg Out at a conference that he was doing at a sci-fi convention. That was, I think, the first straight stand-up comedy set I'd ever seen.
Amazing.
And there's a joke in it that he says about his dog, about how his dog's a bit bougie, and he has to run the tap for a long time, otherwise the dog won't accept the water. And it stayed with me for like 30 odd years. And like, I was lucky enough to see him do a gig a couple of years ago and be on the sort of same bill as him. And
amazing.
It was unreal. And people don't always want to hear that. I was a child when I first encountered your adult work, and it influenced me, but he was very gracious about it.
Yeah, so. I'm sure he was. He gets to gig. He's still gigging.
He's fantastic.
Really? Does he kill? Is he? Really,
and he
good?
Doesn't give a f-, which adds a really nice extra dimension to it. So if you can see him, I would recommend it. It's not just nostalgia. He's genuinely a craftsman. So
I love it.
That said, did he mention your fandom to him when you met him, or did he keep it cool?
I'm not cool though. It wasn't a coolness. I just didn't want to waste his time. He's an important man, he had a thing to do.
No, I'm sure he had jokes to write and tell.
But I did engineer a work situation to go for lunch with Robert Llewellyn, though, in I grossly abused my job working in automotive, because he does a lot in electric cars now.
Mm.
So, I set up a lunch with him and his colleague, completely about electric cars, but also to go for lunch with Crichton. So that was a real treat. Yeah. I think I lasted about 7 minutes before I said it. Like, big fan, by the way. Let's talk only about that at lunch. Let's...
Oh, good. How was he with that? Did he go, what, scrap heap challenge? Yeah, let's chat.
Well, I just started in stand-up as well, which was lovely. So I was telling him all about my first few gigs, and in that way that new stand-up comedians were insufferable. We just want to talk about it, and it's very boring. And if you've been around comedy for a long time, it's not new. I didn't break any new ground. He was so lovely about it, to the point where I was like, oh, do you know what? If you're not busy, I'm doing an open mic tonight. I invited him to an open mic.
That's okay.
Mic.
That's good.
He's a nice
stuff.
Guy. You wouldn't have if he hadn't opened that door to making you think you could.
Exactly.
So glad he didn't come, because I've looked back at the comedy of that era that I was doing. Oh, it was so
no. Oh, that's good. That's another, this all sounds very healthy. You're looking back going, no, it's about the present, I'm better now. Talking of Crichton and Holly, did you have a favourite character? Was there one of the main four or five who really drew you in and made you go, oh, I'm like them?
Well, I think because I was a kid when I first encountered it, the cat for me was my favourite. Like, I'd never seen a character like that before. And he was so flamboyant. I cannot discount rumours that I've based my personal style on him. Looking at some of the items I choose to wear, you know, it's a character that I hadn't seen. I don't think we've seen since. Like, it was so nuanced for such a one note performance. That's
so true. That's that's what we keep coming back to. It is written fairly one dimensionally, but Danny John Jules is so charismatic.
I feel like that's true of every single actor. Every shift that gets put in, they bring so much more to the role than maybe how it's written in the paper. No judgment to the writing, which is also brilliant, but the fantasy casting for this has been an absolute nightmare, because they are so unique in what they bring to each role. That it, yeah, they've made the roles their own in a really quite special way, considering people would think it was just another throwaway sitcom.
Yeah, they are all amazing. And we're sorry to thrust that recasting question on you. It is a bit unfair.
Oh, it's perfect though. I mean, what better to think about one of the shows that you've loved for your whole life and like have the opportunity to put your own people in. But I can see why some people have gone, do you know what? It has to be them because it can't be anybody else. So I was like looking back to see if anybody had made the same decisions that I have, you know, just a bit of check-in and yeah.
So we can come back to general Red Dwarf chat, but seeing as how you brought it up, listener, if you're of a sensitive disposition, we are about to do the recasting question. Have those fingers on the plus 30 seconds buttons. If you can't stand the heat, Vix, tell us what's your recasting? If you had to recast it, how would you?
Well, the cat was easy for me because having spent time with the comedian Jordan Gray, it is the most perfect fit.
Yeah.
As an evolved character, she is everything that the cat is with a bit, obviously, you know, because she's not shallow, but even the character that she plays on stage is very much sort of that kind of high status style.
Oh, brilliant.
That was easy. Straight away, I was like, I'm going to nail this. Right, that's done. And then I moved on to the others and was like, everything else is really hard. For Rimmer, I thought long and hard about this because the thing is, in my initial sort of experiencing of Red Dwarf, I thought he was an annoying, rule-following square. And having watched it again as an adult, I regret to inform my younger self that actually I think sometimes he's got a point.
Oh, no.
And I think adult me, if I had to play like marry, kill, kiss or the sort of slightly crass equivalent, he might make it. He might make it. I might choose him. I probably wouldn't marry him. I would get bored. But surprisingly handsome young man, I thought, in his younger years.
That's interesting. He makes himself unattractive, doesn't he?
Yes.
Like, both in terms of the faces he pulls and the personality he has.
You know, it's sort of heartbreaking when he's like, you know, aren't I a good guy? What if I never find love? I was like, I felt it in my soul when he was going through that. Because I was like, you know, he does everything right. You know, he studied, he wanted a good career, he was ambitious. Like, what is wrong with that? So, you know, I did find a new appreciation for him. But with that in mind, I've picked Catherine Parkinson from the IT Crowd. So I thought I'd genuflect it. Because she's a bit uptight. She's a bit of a rule follower. If you think of her character, Jen Barber's character, there's shades of it there.
When Jen gets the internet in a box. The pride and the smugness she has, that's all Rimmer as well,
right? That internal confidence, you don't know where it's come from. It just feels like, you know, always wears the suit, even though everybody's sobbing around in a basement, you know, takes her job really seriously, even though no one really cares about it. It just feels like
she already is the Rimmer. She's the Rimmer of the IT
Crowd.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, if you look at the IT Crowd, it would have been easy to just sort of cast them in the roles. It's like, and then you could put Chris O'Dowd in as Lister, like that kind of track.
Oh my days.
You've even got Noel Fielding in The Cupboard being a slightly weird deviant who's been on the ship for too long. So,
right. So okay, brilliant.
Yeah, I was like, all right, brilliant.
Ayoade's a shoe-in for Crichton, obviously. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I was like, I didn't really want to cast two IT Crowd people, but I was like, and I think that's when I sort of noticed that the tropes that they use or the kind of the construction they use is quite a well-used composition in terms of personalities. Because I was looking at, because one of my contenders for Lister is Andy Samberg, because Jake Peralta in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, very similar energy, doesn't care much about personal hygiene, seems a bit rubbish, but gets the job done. The ladies seem to love him. We don't know why. Very charming, very immature. And then I was thinking, but actually he married his Rimmer because Amy Santiago was kind of his opposite number, rule following, very stickler for the rules, always wears the uniform in the right way. And it's like,
he married his Rimmer. That's the most romantic thing that's been said on this podcast. Thanks, Vix. That's brilliant.
Lister and Rimmer are a beautiful, happy couple. And then you've got the same thing. You've got Boyle, who takes a sort of Crichton-esque role as well. You know, he's very much subservient. Right. I did fall down a deep hole.
Wait, are we discovering that, like, loads of sitcoms just take the Red Dwarf dynamic?
Like these archetypes of sort of odd couple-y type people.
Do you ever, can you treat us with a Holly even?
Well, this one's sort of, she's not like telefamous known, but if you know her again, it's one worth Googling. So I sort of had Beck Hill in this role, but I saw other people have done it. And somebody in the same genre as that is a comedian called Shan Doxy, Very cool.
Yes,
very
alternative. Yeah.
She's even got the bob, like she's got the hair already. So she's sort of got a modern version of the Holly Bob. And I can see her. She's very whimsical. You can see her sort of following the same kind of kooky paths of whimsy, but there's a lot of intelligence underneath it.
Yeah, absolutely. Listener, Google Shandoxy.
You should. Yeah. She's fabulous. You should Google her anyway, because she's great. But I could see her playing that character very well, because she is very, very cool, very whimsical, very sort of ethereal, not of this world, but very cool.
Amazing choices. Wow, what a cast.
I'd watch this. Like I said, I've spent days like with a spreadsheet. I was like,
that's the thing. It's a horrible process to go through, but it always bears fruit. It really does.
It really does. Good. That wasn't just a recasting. That was like a lesson in sitcom history as well. Thanks, Vix. That was amazing. Did we get a Crichton?
Rich Dio ID was in this spot for me, but like I said, it felt like a massive cop-out to put two IT crowd people in there, even though he's... And I'm not sure he's quite right. I think he's too... just a little bit too eccentric, whereas Crichton's very sort of precise and straight. You know, he goes that way, but he doesn't start that way. He's just a rule follower. And I don't know why. And it's not unflattering, but I think because I can't put my finger on why, I'm not sure how he will take this. But the comedian Robin Morgan, for some reason, came into my mind.
Yes.
I don't know if it's because he's really preppy.
Yeah, I can see
and
that.
And to me, he seems quite a preppy guy. Like,
he's very clean cut, yeah.
Yeah, I think it might be that. But I was like, is this me? But no, because I love Crichton, so it's like, it's not me. But I don't know why, but it's just on vibes alone. I think he'd play that part really well.
He's also got such an agreeable face. I think Crichton, the reason Ayoade maybe isn't a great, perfect Crichton is because you can imagine there are things Ayoade wouldn't do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas Robin Morgan with his nice face.
He's classically handsome, isn't he? So you could sort of put that, you could sort of box those angles up and you'd still get Robin Morgan underneath. I think he could play it very well. He sort of plays up the campness in his comedy sets as well, because he sort of comes out as straight in one of his shows. He's like, I don't know what I was surprised as well. So I think, because there is a lot of camp to Crichton, that I think he could bring out quite well whilst maintaining.
Yeah, that's true. We've talked about how he's a bit coded maternal.
Yeah.
We'll get into talking about that, because this is the first, we're about to talk about the first episode that he's in as Bobby Lou. One last couple of little questions though. Was there an era of Red Dwarf where you were just like, this is everything? Do you have a favourite series or favourite episode?
I think we're going into it now. I think it was sort of the end of 3, beginning of 4. They were my sort of iconic moments. And then I didn't get on with the reboot. I wanted so much from it. And I think when it disappointed me, I just disengaged, because I was surprised when I went onto the BBC website. There are so many more than I thought. Because I was a bit worried about going back and watching the originals, because I haven't done it for probably over a decade. That I was like, oh, what if I don't like it anymore? And you know, when you just want to protect something you loved, I was like, I don't want this to be spoiled for me. I don't want there to be sort of jokes in there that I kind of go, oh, it's a different time. I don't want to forgive it anything.
Yeah.
You've got to be really tentative on the play button, just like 5 seconds. If it's naff, then just, no, I don't want
to
do it.
I've got to say, on the whole, I haven't had to. I don't think there's much.
No, it's great. Mm-hmm.
There's not much I came across, certainly in the sort of the episodes that I've watched, to sort of get back up to speed to this, that I thought, oh, that wouldn't get away. They wouldn't get away with that now. It's a lot of good, clean fun in there.
Yeah,
it's aged very well.
I think it's worth watching those episodes. If you've got a bit of a gap in your schedule and you're like, oh, I'll just check them out. There's enough little moments, enough jokes, enough moments that you will laugh, enough recognisable character moments, and enough kind of really big, nice sci-fi ideas that I'd say it's worth a little check. Just a check rather than a watch. Do you know what I mean?
I will. I'll give it a go. Now I'm back into it now as well, and I've become an evangelist for it. I've started telling other people, like, oh, did you watch Red Dwarf? You should. I'll sit next to you while you watch it, so you can tell me how much you're enjoying it and how much I was right.
I think there might be a shift in Red Dwarf fandom. I think we're getting, maybe the fans are old enough that we're okay to say, no, we do like it.
The world is a much more open-minded place. There's still, don't get me wrong, a long, long way to go. But I think there's a lot more space for people to be exactly who they are without geeks have become, you know, we're proud of that now. You're proud of that. It's not just a box that you put basement dwellers in glasses that never see the light of day and don't know the touch of another human. It's just one aspect of like multifaceted personalities and people. And there's so much community in it as well, because we never got to be connected to each other. I didn't know anybody in school who watched Red Dwarf.
Right.
It was only sort of in the later years of high school, probably, that some boys had discovered it and started to watch it. And then I was very cool in their eyes, which was exciting. So for me, I guess, as a girl that liked that kind of stuff, it didn't have the same price as it did to sort of geeky boys. Geeky boys were not deemed the most sexy, but girls who liked that were sort of, they were a rare find. So you find like, yeah, we can talk to, I can talk to boys about this. And I was a funny girl. I wasn't one of the hot ones. I was a funny girl. So, you know, it was a good asset to have in the arsenal when I was flirting.
That's brilliant. You weaponized your fandom.
Yeah. They're like, all right, pretty good. You like Red Dwarf, name three episodes. Like, you name three episodes. Cause I've got loads. Like, how much time have you got? Let me write you an essay.
Yeah. Where do you want me to start?
But yeah, I think the geek tag was never something to be ashamed of for women particularly. It was something that was prized.
Maybe you've hit the nail on the head just then. Like the fact that that your memory of it was boys challenging you on your fandom. And I feel like the answer is probably going to be men. But maybe the problem was that fans were gatekeepers. Like, that's, are fans still gatekeepers as much these days? It feels there's more of a sharing thing. We didn't have the internet. There might have been a few internet chat forums at the time, but they weren't talking about Red Dwarf.
I think there's less lore in Red Dwarf that people are staunch about because they're half an hour episodes. Like, a lot of the episodes that I rewatched, I would have loved another half hour of them because you're just getting to the crux of something. And you're like, oh, it's finished. Hang on, they've definitely got more to give in this. But I think because it was so light and it covered so much in every episode, there's lore, but it's not the kind of lore that you argue over. It's not, you know, oh, Lisa actually never loved Dave Lister. That's not true. And maybe she did meet Rimmer on Earth. We don't know. It's like, there's not so much lore to argue over because everything you saw was kind of what you got. You got all the same information together.
Yeah, you're right. It would certainly be surprising if you met someone who said the main reason they watched Red Dwarf was the lore.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'd be like, oh.
I can't imagine. Well, I say this, I'll be proved wrong probably almost immediately. I can't imagine there being huge amounts of uproar if they decided to do an all-female Red Dwarf reboot. I think people would be curious. They'd be interested to see how it went. I don't think, you know, what happens with things like Star Wars would happen where people are furious that you've messed with history and you've ruined my childhood and you've trampled all over it. You know, there was a female captain in Star Trek and we all just loved her. She was a badass. Like, I think the sci-fi community is a lot more open-minded generally than other fandoms. But as soon as you get into the fantasy area where there's a lot more, there are more books to be read, there's more things to know more about, there's more whataboutery, it's a slightly blurrier area. Everyone I've ever spoken to about Red Dwarf who also watched Red Dwarf is excited to speak to you.
Yeah.
The reason I got challenged on it was more because teenage boys are teenage boys.
Right.
It was things that weren't for girls when you were like 13 or 14.
Let's do this. We've been shilly-shallying, dilly-dallying long enough. John, introduce us to this episode.
Yes. Right, let me briefly recap backwards. A little bit slower than the opening crawl, but I'll try and make it intelligible. Right, so it's Red Dwarf 3, the saga continuums. The Star Wars-style opening crawl explains at more or less light speed why Holly and Crichton have changed and what happened to Lister being pregnant. Good luck reading it. After a big, brash reworking of the theme tune, we open in more familiar territory. Bunk-based banter, but it's Lister and Kat chatting Flintstones. Meanwhile, a snazzily dressed Rimmer is teaching a nervous Crichton how to fly Starbug, promising a new lease of life for them both. They make it out of the airlock, just about, but this episode is going to crash into the main plotline a lot faster than we are used to. There's a time hole! There's Earth! Where's Nodnol? Crichton spots everything's in reverse. Holly surmises this is the Big Crunch. When the universe is expanded as far as it can, it contracts and time runs backwards. Sure enough, there's a cafe patron happily regurgitating an eclair, a newspaper stuffed with backwards logic, the armed raider who forces staff to accept 10 grand, the roll-off deodorant that keeps you hot and sweaty, and a theatrical agent requires novelty acts. What do Rimmer and Crichton do that's a novelty? In this world, everything. Lister and Kat track the Lost Boys through the orange whirly thing in space. They engage the cloaking device, which conveniently conceals both the ship and the production budget. Something's not right. Lister feels like he's been beaten up. And Rimmer and Crichton seem to be famous? The smart party realise. They're in Bulgaria. They find out where the sensational Reverse Brothers are performing Eti Not Evil and witness their astonishing act, eating an egg and drinking a glass of water. Forwards. The Reverse Brothers don't want to leave. They're happy, successful and only getting younger, but they have no choice. The pub manager fires them for the fight they're about to have. After a big barroom tidy in which Lister's injuries are healed, peace breaks out, which, if you think about it, makes you wonder what they got fired for. Still, they have to go. Unfortunately, Kat doesn't consider the consequences of doing his business backwards, resulting in a freaky hairdo, a new walk and PTSD. Okay, there's so much we could say about backwards. I think let's at least start by trying to tackle it forwards. So let's go to the very beginning. we've obviously got big, brash, dynamic credits that show us we're going to go to bigger places than we've been before. But this opening pair of scenes, I think, shows us that in a different way, Vix. We've been on the bunks before loads. This time we've got Kat with Lister, and then we've got Rimmer with Crichton.
Really unusual combos. Like, Kat and Lister, you don't see them together on their own in a scene. And it's like, I get it why. You know, you do. I did sort of miss, I think, Rimmer's contribution to that kind of conversation. It was cute, but you noticed it. You noticed the absence, I think. And as a comeback for seeing, yes. You're like, hang on, a lot happened. I'm processing all that text. We're back in this bedroom like nothing's happened, like a Thomas Beckett one-act play. What's like...
Do you get the impression they maybe wrote the conversation before they decided which characters were going to go in it? It's such a good joke and build.
It's a great
It's
dialogue,
sort of off. It's almost off brand for Kat, because like, it's a cultural reference that... Has he been watching the Flintstones? Was he watching? I needed more information, because he sort of operates on a sort of different level to other people. He doesn't always engage in these kind of sort of earthbound topics. So
He makes a surprising number of 20th century cultural and social references, actually. He's obviously been absorbing archive somewhere in the ship.
But they are all mid-century still, though, aren't they? Like, he dresses like Little Rich out of the 50s, and Flintstones was the 60s?
I think so, yeah.
It's a classic pullback and reveal joke, though, isn't it? Just like, oh, it's silly to talk about this anyway, you know, she'd never give me the time of day. It's such a classic joke construct. It's beautifully executed conversationally, but it is that kind of twist where you're like, oh, they've accepted this card. Nope, that's not why.
It's great.
It is almost a bit of stand-up, isn't it?
It is, as well. I think it does. It's like a two-person stand-up bit.
I think what it does do is it gives us Kat with a bit more personality, right? So we were saying before about how he's this quite one-note character as written, but Danny just finds so many colours to play with around that one note. Mixing metaphors there. But but here we've got, you know, he's got the sense of an emotional life, like a bit of complexity here, a bit of insecurity, which you just haven't really quite seen before.
It's quite laddie as well. It's like proper laddie, like locker room banter. You know, I'd go with Betty, but I'd be thinking about Wilma. Like, it's such a normal conversation, like overheard in the pub kind of pub chat, that it is.
It's so wistful, like they're really taking it seriously as well. I'd be thinking of Wilma, the way they play that. Just, it's really, he's there in that moment.
The juxtaposition of sort of the epic start, where it's like all this stuff has happened, all the big music, and then it's 2 pints of lager and a packet of crisps on a spaceship. It's
But Kat does have his hair in curlers, so that laddishness is mitigated a little bit, right?
That's true.
Well, he curls his leg hair to help the shape, as we know. Like, he's au fait with curlers. It's fine. Personal grooming is at high. And also, like, late 80s, early 90s, like, new romantics, glam rock, it was all the style. So, realistically, to get those styles... Spandau Ballet, they're in the Rollers. Like, we know.
It must be.
Yeah. Fergus, you've got a theory about the Flintstones scene, right?
Just that I think it works on a number of different levels. There is the laddishness. There is the classic kind of switcheroo punch line to this scene. But I do also think it shows, at a slightly higher narrative level, how mad these two people have gone.
Yeah.
How much they've lost their minds. We laugh kind of because they're being daft about a cartoon. But if you stepped, like John and I do far too often, step back from the joke and analyse it a bit, maybe further than it deserves, then you'd go, hang on, no, the reason this is funny is because we're watching two people who've lost their marbles.
Yeah.
They're talking about cartoon characters in the context of reality, not just them having a chance with them, but these cartoons' reactions.
I don't know. I have those conversations, though. There are many, many characters in Studio Ghibli who get it. Like, I don't know if it's that far-fetched that they'd be having this conversation even if they were in a pub. I think that you're right, though. There's that self-awareness of when he checks with Kat that he's not saying something absolutely absurd, and then Kat validates, no, it's completely normal. Like, good, I thought I was losing my mind for a minute. But the validation of an evolved cat on this spaceship that I'm in is enough for me to know this is fine.
That's very true. Yeah. Look at the whole scene. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just my friends.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify.
Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's have a look at the other pairing then for this adventure. So we've got Rimmer and Crichton. Again, quite a different dynamic for Rimmer here. He's got someone he can actually boss around that's going to take it.
Yeah, he's actually, you know, to see him take that kind of consultative boss role, he's really enjoying it. And it's that, it's like the Jen from the IT Crowd thing all over again. You can see him really sort of stepping into it, like taking it seriously with his clipboard. He's living his best life.
Yeah, yeah.
With that, with a compliant person who doesn't know him well enough to not respect him yet and doesn't have the facilities. Like, he could be exactly who he wants. It must be such a treat when you have been typecast by everybody that you know and you've got no chance of seeing anybody else, really, like any other humanoid to make a first impression on.
Maybe that's why he reacts comparatively well to being ejected out of Starbuck by accident.
But it's the classic deadpan that Chris Barry does so well.
Yeah, yeah. This episode is full of great Chris Barry line readings. Yeah. When they arrive on Earth and he just asks Holly, what the smeg is going on? It's so underplayed when you consider how insane what's happening is. They're on Earth and everything's happening backwards. It's just
nothing faces them anymore. This weariness, isn't there? It's like,
yeah, right.
It's the same energy as, oh, you know, I could move it up, but I'd have to change the bulb. Like, there's just this kind of
yeah, there is, and that just makes it so much fun, doesn't it? Yeah. All right, well, let's look at Backwards Earth then, right? Because this is what people came to this episode for. It's high concept. It's not the best special effects budget, but it is high concept stuff. What do you reckon to Backwards Earth? Is it well realised in your view? Does it stand up?
I was really struggling with this, and I have been struggling with it. Just like, oh, but they've changed the consequences of it. So surely, how would that impact, considering it's unrolling backwards? Like, why would the cars be going backwards? Why would they not have been engineered? Did it go backwards at some point? Why have they been engineered so you can't, the windows don't see out to where you're driving? So you're like, I got myself into a proper...
Why is the writing backwards?
Yeah, like
you kind of have to go with the backwards logic that you're presented with, and then stop thinking about it any part, because otherwise, it's riddled with contradictions. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
there's a shot in one of the kind of Nod Noll montages of a bloke smoking a fag. That's actually Rob Grant, the writer, co-writer. That's him smoking a fag backwards, and I imagine that in backwards world, there are people who were born with
cigarettes inside them.
Yeah, they get healthier by smoking and getting the tar out of their lungs.
Yes, it's a medicinal process.
It's very unpleasant backwards world, isn't it?
Like everything about it, not everything, you know. Some things are better, like the idea of sort of aging backwards into a baby, lovely, like,
that's true.
And do you know what, every time I've watched this episode up until the point I knew I had to talk about it, I just accepted it wholeheartedly. I've gone, it's backwards, of course it is.
Yeah
Nod Noll, yeah. Of course, that's exactly how I would realise this if I was in charge of this episode. So it's only when you try and pick at it, and I think they just rely on people to not.
Exactly.
You're ruining your own fun, aren't you, if you do it like that? And it's the same with, it's like, I was like, they're not speaking backwards. Like, you can tell the bits where they are. And I watch things with subtitles on now because my attention span is awful. And they did know, like, the subtitles know when things are backwards, and they put the words up in a way that they don't with the gibberish.
Wow, that's cool.
Which I thought was quite a nice touch.
Yeah, well done there. Yeah. Oh, that's quite a lot of work.
Yeah. They had bothered to put the sort of letters backwards, whereas with a lot of it just did sound like Dutch or Bulgarian. That would have been so much fun. Imagine being an extra on that.
I think that eclair lady really didn't know what was happening, apparently. No. She was just told to eat an eclair and drink some tea, and they'd have some audience laughter at a later date. Like, what a weird gig.
Yeah, because the audience laughter doesn't make any sense.
That's your day, thanks.
I bet it's really hard as well when someone asks you to do something that's a completely natural action. As soon as you have to do it.
Yes.
While someone's watching. It's like, I can't sit in a chair on a stage without being aware of what my arms and legs are doing. Oh, like, I can sit in a chair. I'm good at it. I put a lot of hours into it. I'm good at it. As soon as I'm in a chair where other people can see me, I'm like, where do I put my arms and legs? So being told to just consume a pint normally, I can't imagine what I do with that brief.
No, exactly.
Yeah, it is really difficult. And I think that probably explains the odd expression on her face. She looks kind of displeased at being there, right? She's not really savouring that eclair, is she? Regardless of the way she's eating it or regurgitating or whatever it is she's actually meant to be doing.
I feel like somebody surely has now reversed everything so we can watch it all forwards, because that feels like a sort of DVD extra I'd like to watch.
I don't want to skip too far ahead, but they have reversed the Arthur Smith scene. Have you seen that on YouTube? Yeah. I love that.
I think that might have been one of the smeg up or smeg out videos, actually.
Oh, it probably was, yeah.
Arthur Smith says, "You are a stupid, square-headed, bald git, aren't you? I'm pointing at you, but I'm not actually addressing you. I'm addressing the one prat in the entire country who's bothered to get hold of this recording, turn it round, and actually work out the rubbish that I'm saying. What a poor, sad life he's got." So there you go. That's the message, the hidden message from Arthur Smith in his backwards scene. He's taken the mickey out of anyone who does kind of pretty much exactly what we're talking about.
It's the most Arthur Smith thing I've ever heard as well, which very much helps, right? Anybody who's encountered him in the wild, that is, he played himself there.
Square-headed bald git sounds very Arthur Smith.
Yeah. But he's doing it with a twinkle in his eye, right? Because at the end of the day, the only reason he's doing that is he knows somebody is going to get hold of that footage, is going to play it back, and is going to absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's a perfect Easter egg in a time before there were that many, because this level of detail of combing through didn't exist, because we're all doing it at best on VHS.
Yeah.
So, in terms of sort of rewinding something back, we just didn't have the capability to examine things this close. And and even if we did, where would we tell people? Like,
that's very true.
Well, exactly.
I've seen what he says backwards. Okay.
Yeah. How would I tell someone? Like, there were no forums.
Yeah, and they go, "What are you talking about? Oh, Red Dwarf backwards." It's, "Well, how can I watch it? You've got to buy a VHS. How much is that going to be? 20 quid. Well, that's like 50 quid in today's
money. You had to watch the episode last week because it's not available, but let me describe it to you, because in no way will I make it sound
I reckon Arthur Smith might have been playing to the studio audience a bit. It must have been so weird being in the audience for this episode, right? Yeah. And all you're seeing is Ed Bye asking actors to do things forward and promising that it'll be funny when they watch it back. So Arthur Smith was probably actually throwing that for the audience, right?
Yeah.
There's 200 people going, how is this funny?
Yeah.
I think that might have been funny to them at that stage.
Yeah. Recording,
right? You've been there for hours. Everything's funny.
Apparently they only had two machines at the entire BBC that could play footage backwards. So figuring out any of this stuff, frankly, is a miracle. You don't have to be, this is a dreadful segue, but I'm just trying to get us back to an episode-specific question again. You don't have to be the smart party to really... I wanted to ask those of you guys that have watched it, because I haven't, Vix, I've not rewatched Red Dwarf since the 90s pretty much, so I haven't seen this one in years. The smart party, does that come back? Cat and Lister as a little double act calling themselves the Smart Party. Do they do the Red Dwarf shuffle again, or is it a one and done for this episode?
I can't think of it. Yeah, because I noticed it was novel, but I can't think of an occasion. But they are really cute. They're just dopes, aren't they?
I really like it. It's a nice, fun little moment. It feels like it was meant to be a bit.
Craig Charles and Danny Donchels have that chemistry in Stasis Leak, episode 4 of series 2. They have that moment where they're just walking down the corridor, and because it's Lister and Cat, they said... Clearly the actors had a chat. They said, let's do something together.
Yeah.
And what they end up doing on camera is they both walking down the corridor, rolling their shoulders and arms, going, yeah. That sounds like, that feels like a smart party moment.
It's so cute. Because they are very much two factions. They're sort of the rule followers and the rule breakers. And they do consider themselves the cool kids. But do you know what? They get to where they need to go. You know, they don't take the cues. They don't acknowledge, they don't solve the clues, but it's like an escape room. If you find the key and you get out of the room, it doesn't matter how you bloody got there. They found them. You know, maybe they are the smart party. The IQs weren't there. They still made it. They managed to communicate. Would Rimmer and Crichton have been able to effectively communicate a free lift? I'm not sure they would have.
I think that's a really good point.
They've got two very different skill sets.
That's true. They both get to nod.
They got their points. They worked out how to do it.
It's true. they are 100% that team on The Apprentice that all the way through you're thinking, oh, they've lost, and then they turn out to have won. They are absolutely that. This episode, every character just leans into it and enjoys it, right? It's a bit of a romp in that sense. Obviously, there's the big fight, but it's not even a fight.
It's a holiday, isn't it? And it's novel for us as a viewer to see them on Earth, to see them interact with Earthlings in general. It's like, that was a big, exciting moment to see them come back to Earth, even in any way, shape or form.
I did want to touch on that. So it's only a really, really small moment, but it's obviously potentially really quite consequential in terms of the story that we've been watching so far before we realise this isn't quite the Earth that we know. But Lister's I'm home moment.
It's a credit to the acting, isn't it? Like, you feel it. He can give you any emotion that he wants to give you. There's, for such a lightweight show, you get it so often. There's so many moments of real poignancy underneath all of it. You do sort of feel it.
I think that's one of Craig's superpowers, actually, as an actor, is that he can just imbue an awful lot of emotion into really small moments, and he never overdoes it.
The thing is, the show would have worked even as it was written. Yeah. But the fact that they took it and did so much with it made you care so much, even about the characters that were really annoying, even about the the anthropomorphism of the Scutters. Like, I would give my life for them. They created these. They haven't even got a face, and I was like, I would fight for them. what they create, because they like them as well, because they care about them, and you do. You know, Talky Toaster, I would take a hammer to. You know, it's like, it's every single character. There's not a single passenger from a character point of view, and there are so few characters on at any given moment. They carry it so well.
Yes, they do.
There's always something new to be found, and I think that's a real skill. Again, they're underrated. I don't think they got the credit they deserve for making that what it was.
Speaking of beautifully touching, poignant performances, the sensational Reverse Brothers. What a magical act.
Oh, again, I think I've seen that show at Edinburgh Fringe as well. It's so gloriously underwhelming as well. There's so much they could do backwards that would have been impressive, and they didn't bother. That's the
it's
beauty
so
of it.
Short.
They took the most banal, tiny, average things and made them a spectacle. Like, you were with, like, Lister and Kat in the audience, like, what is going on? Yeah. Why are these people so into this?
It's no wonder they don't want to leave, right? Like, these guys have got nothing to do.
And they're nerds as well. I mean, you know, they are not the popular, you know, Crichton has the vibe of a, you know, not a popular kid in school. Like, that's built into his DNA. But, you know, Rimmer's never been the popular guy. He's never been the guy in the spotlight, the one that everybody wanted to be. He's never had that. He's never been someone
he's
who's
never been
applauded.
Yeah.
That is addictive, you know, to be a big deal anywhere when all you want really is to be taken seriously and to be a big deal. You get it beyond what it's written. You know, it's easy for them. They're having a nice time, but you get it from that character's point of view, because for the first time they matter. And they're the star. They're not the other guy.
Yeah. I want to touch as well on the sort of the philosophical arguments that they set up about the good points and bad points of living on backwards world. Like, you know, the millions of people coming to life as Hitler retreats across Europe, liberating France and Poland, as opposed to Lister seeing the other side, you know, Santa Claus stealing children's presents. I really like that. Yeah. That scene.
St. Francis of Assisi just harms little animals.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's the kind of two sides to every story, isn't it? It's like Lister was only thinking of it from a selfish point of view. He's quite young. He didn't have many years left on the clock, whereas Rimmer was thinking of the years he could get to relive and do things a little bit differently. So they were coming at it from two very different points of view, not for the first time.
Yes, but right. That's the thing with this episode, is it's all consistent. The logic of Backwards World is all consistent in terms of being funny and in terms of what it means for the characters, which are the two most important things. Once you start thinking about it super logically, then obviously you have all kinds of questions, like, why are they actually being fired? As I said in the Bracer, you know, they're tidying the place up. Why are they being fired for that?
Well, more importantly, why aren't they being hunted by scientists for their superhuman capabilities?
Quite so, yes.
Yeah, but then you get back into that, you know, what do people know? Is anyone trying to understand the world forwards, even though it's being lived backwards? Then you get back into that and you have to stop because you're broken.
Yeah, so maybe a messy pub is a preferable state to a clean one.
It could be. Listeners, email in.
Yeah, let us know. Help us understand.
Seriously.
What's going on? But the Unrumble, the Barroom Tidy, that's quite a bravura sequence, right?
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's proper, like, old school slapstick as well. And, like, when Dave says, I've just remembered why my back hurts, and just sort of leans into it, it's just...
Yeah. Here, mate, have your tooth back, all of that. It's just really nice.
Takes it back in. And then just that last moment though, where Kat takes the money out of the charity box and he's like, well, you know, it's for charity. Like, he's finally understood the rules of the world.
That's it.
Yes. Like, because that's another one where it's actually backwards, where she says thank you and he's like, oh, you know, it's a good cause. Just walks out with it. Sort of
It is good. But does he mean it? He can't spend it on Red Dwarf, can he?
Well, that's the thing. Money, you literally can't give it away. So what's the point? That currency has no meaning. It's just, but it's just because you can. Why do cats do anything? Because they can.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he's a cat.
Yeah, he can. Yeah, which accounts for why he really badly messes up right at the last minute in this episode.
Yeah.
Which sends us out on a real high.
It's such a good punchline.
It's a great visual, isn't it?
Can I be really vulgar? We might have to cut this out even, Alex. Is it wee or poo?
I think it's the second one.
In the bushes. Yeah, I think so as well. Like, the trauma that he experiences made my mind immediately go to that, for sure.
But that means he crouched over a pile of poo. Yeah.
He probably wasn't looking.
If you're in backwards world, don't
crouch he backed into it. How would he have known?
Yeah.
But it was just one more horrible thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, there we go.
But it's like the most puerile joke that you can end on. But because they're sort of saying farewell to Earth again, there's something really nice about that last laugh. And they, you know, they all had a nice time. And it's a moment of accord between Lister and Rimmer as well, where they sort of agree.
That's
very
true.
It's a nice moment between the two of them where they're like, oof.
They almost look like they're corpsing in that moment. They almost look like they're trying to stifle a laugh. Because of what's DJJ's punchline, don't ask.
Yeah. And that's another nice example of, we've talked about this before, like the generosity of Grant and Naylor's writing to the audience. Like, they let us complete the joke, and that, which is one of the reasons why it's such a nice note to end on, I think. There are so many brilliant moments in this episode. Vix, if you had to pick one, what would be your kind of best bit of Backwards?
That's really hard to be honest, because I do love the exchange that Rimmer and Crichton have in the Starbuck. It is everything that I love about the sort of deadpan style. You know, oh, I don't know. I've only learned on Starbuck One's controls. They're the same. I know, that's the point. It's like, those moments are so iconically canon for me that I love seeing them play out. But you've got to give it to that Barroom Tidy, I think. Seeing them do physical comedy as well and having them unpick all of those things, it was something a bit different for them, and they did it so well.
Yeah.
Like watching Crichton come and like moves a chair as well, but even like them sort of being outside of the backward cycle because they're aware of it. Like nobody else is aware of it apart from them. So it's the awareness. So Crichton's sort of passing a chair over and like a grimace and sort of looking at each other and making eye contact, communicating outside of the narrative. It's just a lovely piece of work.
It stands the test of time for sure.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of it was probably was done manually in a way that maybe now it'd be CGI as well, and there's something cool in that. There's something to be said for that kind of physical comedy.
There definitely is. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's clowning at its best, in the good way.
It is. Well, speaking of clowning at its best, or at least comedy at its best, if not even financial advice at its best, Vix Layton, where can people find you?
Everywhere. Mainly on Twitter, at Vix Layton. I'll be talking about this for a long time. Cannot let this go. This has started off so many spin-off conversations for me because I tweeted yesterday that I was having a nightmare. Loads of people DM me their choices, which was lovely and helpful.
Oh,
but awesome. But it's interesting to see the way people interpret characters differently. So their castings say a lot more about how they experience the characters and who they think they are, I think.
Yes.
That's why we ask the questions. Yeah. The answers are so different. It means everyone's seeing those characters so differently.
Yeah. Awesome. So my friend said, like, Kathy Burke for Lister, and I was like, I don't get that at all. Oh. I sort of do. Because it's the slobbishness and the sort of don't give a f-. And someone said Jack Black, and again, I sort of see it, but I think we forget how conventionally handsome in the late 80s, early 90s Lister is. You can believe that he's quite successful. Not that he can't maintain a relationship, you know. He didn't recognise a good thing when he had it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's going back through that with Lister and Rimmer and their different approach to that. But he's just an everyday man. He's not a particularly slobbish man. He's not a, like, that's not his biggest characteristic. So I was surprised by those castings. But as soon as you hear them, you go, yeah, actually, I can see that. And I don't know if that's just really well-written characters where it's the same as Friends, isn't it? Where you go, oh, I'm the Chandler, or Sex and the City, yeah. I'm the Carrie. It's like, actually, you've got three things that are in common and you've identified, you've overlaid yeah, yourself it. Onto this character.
Yeah,
I'm a bit fussy, so I am like this character with OCD. Yeah.
Exactly. I know all the Space Corps directives, so I am.
There you go.
Yes, I think it's your own experience that feeds into it. So yeah, I'm at Vix Layton if you'd like to join the chat there. and same on Instagram. I have got a TikTok, but oh, it's woeful. Don't look at that. Okay. I've got a comedy podcast that is on a bit of a hiatus called The Comedy Arcade. It's a panel show, but I do it as a live show. I'll be taking it back to Edinburgh Fringe this year, so look out for that. So many people that you've had on this show have been panelists on my show. Like, we are a Venn diagram of my interests.
Oh, brilliant.
Awesome.
So yeah, check that out.
Well, Vix, you've been amazing. You'll have to come back on the show.
Yeah. I'd love to. Well, you can have me watch one of the new ones now, sort of for the first time, and then I can tell you what I think about it.
Do you hear that, Alex? We've got that recorded. We have a volunteer for the later series.
I will happily come back. I've had such a brilliant time. I could talk to you all day. This is a joy of a show. This is such a good idea.
Thanks, Vix.
It was so lovely to see you. Have a lovely rest of the evening. I will listen to the rest of this podcast when it comes out.
Oh, Vix Layton.
That was great.
Lovely, lovely company to discuss all things backwards.
Yeah, that was brilliant. I suspect we could have talked for hours and hours more. I just want to refer to something she said.
Mm.
Crichton doesn't know Rimmer well enough not to respect him yet.
Oh, yeah, I like
which
that.
I think was an amazing, amazing thing to say. It kind of reminded me of that line in The Dark Knight, you either die a hero or live long enough to be a villain in Red Dwarf world. You either die a Lister or live long enough to, yeah.
Yes.
Crichton doesn't know Rimmer that well yet. Crichton's new.
He is new. Well, this is it. He's had a bit of I don't want to say reprogramming. He's been reassembled, hasn't he, as we discussed last time, in terms of that, the explanation for why he's different from the character that we saw. We talked about that on the Between series episode, listener. If you missed that, you can go back and hear all the insights.
I think Vix kind of pointed out both the cause and the outcome of these new pairings, without kind of necessarily putting the two things together in the app. Why do we start with Lister and Cat?
Mm.
Well, because now that Crichton's around, it makes sense for Lister and Cat to be a pair and Crichton and Rimmer to be a pair.
Yeah, the smart party and the boss party.
If you went through all four of them and said, who in this group of four would you rather hang out with? Lister and Cat are definitely going to choose each other.
Yes.
Rimmer's definitely going to choose Crichton, and Crichton probably doesn't get a choice.
Or Crichton's going to choose the person who enables him to fulfil his programming, right? Which is the one who's going to order him to do stuff, which Lister will be too nice to do.
Crichton likes being given stuff to do. Does that mean he likes Rimmer's company?
I'm not sure it's the same thing. I think there's a rich history of butler-related film and literature that would teach us so. But yeah, Robert Llewellyn's great. We're going to talk about how brilliant Robert Llewellyn is a lot from this point on. Because he's amazing.
He's in it now. We can talk about him. And I've been holding something back.
Oh, yeah.
And now Robert Llewellyn is in the show proper, I feel like I can say it. We've had so many guests who are like, oh, yeah, I've gigged with Norman Lovett, I've met Hattie Hayridge, I bumped into Chris Barry backstage at a theatre, all that kind of stuff. I've spent a day with Robert Llewellyn.
Oh, you did?
I spent a day at his house.
Yes.
In the countryside. I used to be an environmental video journalist, and I was out there interviewing him about all these amazing renewable energy things he had going on in his house. He was a very, very nice man, and exactly as you'd expect, erudite and very enthusiastic and very positive about all the stuff. However, I do fall into the majority of people that were loath to ask him about Red Dwarf, unfortunately.
Really? You managed
it? So as much as it was a very exciting day for me, I was with a couple of, the editor of the website I was working for was there, and he was very confused by my behaviour.
Oh, I'm so happy he's really nice. I mean, we've heard, by and large, nothing but nice things about the cast, and it's so reassuring. Everybody seems to have gigged with Norman Lovett.
Let's do a little mini episode on going to see Norman Lovett.
Oh, I'd love that.
I think that'd be super cool.
I would love it.
Was that a deliberate pun?
I honestly keep doing it. Every time I talk about Norman Lovett, I end up saying I love it quietly, and it's not deliberate, no. It just so happens that I do love him as a performer, and I love his choices. I just think he's great. That moves us on quite nicely, actually, to The Change of Holly. What amazed me about this, so Norman didn't come back because he'd met his wife moved to Edinburgh, was filming his own series, which we've mentioned before, called I Love It in Glasgow, his own comedy show. And he didn't want to travel all the way down to London for the Red Dwarf rehearsals. His argument was, I'm just on a box anyway, I can just turn up and just do it, right? They tried to barter with him over money and reduced days, and basically just, yeah, the negotiation fell apart. So you would think they just went to Hattie because she just played Hilly in Parallel Universe, but apparently no, she had to audition. She remembers being at an audition with about 10 other people, including, in her words, proper actors. She'd only done stand-up at this time. Extraordinary to me that they even thought twice about casting anyone else, because she's so great. And she was brilliant from the word go.
She is doing something different to Holly.
Yes, I agree.
She is doing a... Yeah. Sorry. Wow. For me, her Holly expresses, I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe I'm here.
Yeah.
Quite.
Yeah.
Whereas really Lovett's Holly was more of a kind of just a casual... They're both different sides of the same senility.
Yes.
In a ship's computer, maybe.
Yes. She's a bit more rabbit in the headlights. Yeah, that's a really good observation, man. I hadn't thought of that before, but you're right.
It does make a bit of sense that if they were looking for someone to copy Norman Lovett, they'd look at a few people before they went, but why would we do this?
Mm.
We already have Hattie.
Yes.
Did they see a lot of women for the part? Did they know they were going to gender swap it already?
Oh, I'm not sure.
It says proper actors, but were they...
I'm assuming no. I'm assuming it wouldn't be the obvious... Because if the thought initially was, let's gender swap, then surely that would just lead you even more directly to, well, we've literally already seen that, so let's just cast Hattie Heyridge.
Mm.
So I guess they must have been watching guys, and maybe they threw her in as a wild card, maybe. I honestly don't know, actually. It's not even worth me speculating on that, but I would have thought that they must have seen blokes, otherwise you'd just go straight to her. Email in if you know, listeners, because a lot of you do know more about this stuff than we do. We are, as we always say, lovers, not experts.
Email us at bestthanlifepod@gmail.com or find us on our socials at itsbtlpod.
Oh, and by the way, do give us a 5-star rating review on the podcast apps and stuff.
It really does help.
It really does. It really does.
The change of cast isn't the only thing that's shifted. Obviously, the music.
Oh, the music. The whole opening credits. It's got opening credits now rather than just a slow, somber crawl.
Yeah.
With a little joke about painting.
Like our guests have said previously, you tick off the shots you've seen, yeah, as you see the episode relating to it. I think they mostly come from the first three anyway. They flash up mostly. It's close-ups of the main cast and the big special effects shots.
Yes.
And that's great. And the music goes so well with it. And I don't know if it was ever jarring to me or if it feels as natural a shift as it does now.
It's hard to say. From my point of view, Series 4 was the first one that I saw. So for me, it was always like this. Yeah. And the strange thing was going back and watching 1 and 2 and going, oh, it used to be quite different in terms of that stuff. But yeah, I mean, to me, it really feels like we're getting to home territory now.
I can't help but feel that as a young boy, starting to understand music and listening to, like, Led Zeppelin and Prince. And I remember loving the opening sequences of the first two series.
Mm.
But when this one happened, and maybe this is a false memory, but I'm so sure I went, all right, now we've turned it up a gear. Yes. Here we go.
That is what it's saying, isn't it, to anyone that's watched along up to this point. It's just, look, we're going somewhere different with this. We're going bigger.
And they do.
Yeah.
They do. Our very first episode, they go to Earth. They do a load of backwards stuff.
Yeah.
This is worth noting, I think. This is interesting. There's only 5 episodes of Red Dwarf that needed a stuntman. Gareth Milne is in this episode. It's quite an interesting... I think you could very easily work it out if you had an encyclopedic knowledge of Red Dwarf.
Mm.
The others are DNA, Justice, The Inquisitor and Terraform. There are many, many listeners right now going, yeah, obviously. those are the 5 with the big stunts in.
Yeah, and interesting that they all fall within this coming run of what a lot of people consider the classic years as well, right?
Yeah. There's moments being thrown through a pub window and, oh, yeah, yeah, it's good stuff. It's good. Oh, what an episode. The Reverse Brothers... They have EHT in a star on the poster.
Yes.
So presumably read backwards or rather forwards, they're actually known as the Reverse Brothers. Just everyone is at the top of their game. Howard Goodall comes back with an absolutely rocking theme, a version of the theme tune.
Yeah.
The props department are like, we're going to make some crazy stuff for this.
Yes.
We're going to have an aged, like, milestone saying nod null.
Yeah.
There's so much effort gone into the spirit of silliness as well.
Yeah, there really is.
And I think they succeed in making their audience go, that's fine. It's worth it. Forget the... don't have gripes. You should be too busy laughing.
Yes.
And enjoying the awesome moments like the bar cleanup. This is the episode to do that shift with, I think.
Definitely. Possibly the only people not blown away by this was... the people of, I think it's Manchester where they film Nod Noll, that exterior shot of Rimmer and Crichton walking through a sea of backwards people.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're walking backwards and everyone else is walking forwards in real life. Nobody's bothered by these two crazies.
That's very true. But like, okay, so there's a moment where Rimmer is kind of trying to cover up his H with his hair.
Mm.
He's sitting next to Crichton.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Again, that's a don't think about it.
There's nothing really to say about it other than it's amazing, but we didn't even mention Crichton's disguise in the cafe when he disguises himself to look more normal.
Oh, yeah. Comes in a Ronald Reagan mask and a kind of Sith cloak.
Just fantastic. That's so good. It is so good. And, oh, do you know what? Speaking of costumes, we've got to give a shout out to the other Howard, Howard Burden, new costume designer for Series 3. And he's given us so much. Lister's iconic leather jacket.
Yes, great.
It's easy to forget. Like, we've only just finished watching Series 2, but it's easy to forget that that wasn't there the whole time because it becomes such an indelible part of the character from this point.
I think he got both sides of it so, so right. The brief for Cat is impeccable.
Yeah, it really is.
Like the curlers in the first scene, he kind of starts to show us, we see a little bit of how Cat works behind the scenes.
Yes.
But Lister's whole get-up and then Rimmer next to that.
Yeah.
Rimmer's costume is so clever. It's dated poorly, especially the kind of the hat part with the little microphone thing on it. The tunic he wears, I think, is such a clever costume design. And again, this standby for some reading far too much into it. But it's very glossy. It's rainbow, almost chameleonic shifting in light from red almost to green. But like, it's also very flat. It's very nothing. It draws the attention up to the face, which is good for a performance. But also it's kind of implying that Rimmer is very much sheen with no contour.
Do you know what? That you're absolutely spot on. And I thought I knew where you were going with that, and you weren't actually. You were making another really brilliant point. But I know for a fact that Howard Burden's thinking was very much about that shine. It was a two-tone fabric, which he used deliberately. And his thinking was to make him appear more holographic, that shine. So that was the idea. But I think you're 100% right about how it works. In fact, he's thought about it a lot. So the whole cat thing, his brief to himself was costumes that would aid the sense of cat-like movement.
Mm.
And Lister's jacket comes from the art school backstory, even though Lister only went to art school for a day. But he was like, you know, as an art school type kid, he was like, well, Lister would probably customise his clothes, so let's cover it with badges and patches and stuff. So really well thought through, and it just works. All the choices he's made work beautifully. Even making Crichton robotic rather than sticking with the butler theme from season 2.
Yes.
It helps to make that impression of the budget being upped and the scope of everything being increased. It really sort of reinforces that, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they've got the confidence to have a go at a proper robot now. And why wouldn't you? You've got the finest robot actor in British history.
That must have been a collaboration with Mel Bibby, the production designer.
Very possibly, yeah.
That needs to be quite practical, that suit, I imagine.
Yes.
Imagine there was a production coordinator going, I'm sorry, how long is it going to take Robert to get in and out of this costume and makeup?
A week? Yeah.
Exactly.
We could go on about backwards forever, I think. I'm tempted to just start the episode again and do it all backwards, but we can't.
Let's give it a go. See, that's my impression of backwards talking. It does sound a bit like I'm doing a racist Swedish accent, doesn't it? That's how that comes out. Swedish listeners, we know you don't sound like that.
Is it about time to ride off into the sunset?
Yes. We have to prepare, John. For next week, we are marooned with Will Duggan.
Another all-time classic.
It's a real hot streak for the Red Dwarf. It's going to be a hot streak for us too.
It is.
Can't wait to see you there, listener.
See you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.